on to D-Day.
Yeah.
In this area. Am I right in thinking you were on leave or something, is that right?
No, I came on leave prior to D-Day a couple of times. And I knew what was happening here because I had to have a pass to get home, to come through to this area. There were troops, of, you know, at the road, where the road goes through to Calshot. It's about a mile and a half up the road here, isn't it? North, if you go along that, go east and then up, follow the road up. Well, there was a junction there, and there were service people there with guns so that no one could come south of that area and or east of that area because they were building the Mulberry Harbours down in around Stone Point area, Stanswood Bay it's called, around that corner, and also up at the Beaulieu River. Well, in fact, on one of the leaves at home, which couldn't have been too long before this, the D-Day event, there was, well, he's a great pal of mine, the old harbour master up at Butler's Hiram, was coming out with his little launch leading the towing of the tugs, towing the barges down this river here. These huge caissons, they weren't barges, they were caissons, concrete caissons, weren't they, that they towed across the other side to beach and to make runways or roadways in for all the personnel and materials that had to land there. But it was quite a busy area at that time. There were all sorts of things. We lived at number one, which is that end of these cottages, and my mother, our father had died by then, but our mother had two men from London who worked up further up the beach here, putting in tubular scaffolding with canvas on top to represent submarine pens. And it was bombed, but mainly with incendiaries. I don't know why they use incendiaries on submarine pens, because they were mock submarine pens, but obviously they were made to look like a long concrete emplacement. You know, and still some of the rusty poles down in the ground, that, you know, they were just, they weren't galvanized, they were just tubular steel pipes.
Where, so whereabouts was that built?
Just about, just in front of Inchmary House, you know, which was where the Free French were. I think I told you that one day I was on leave and I thought, well, I'll take the family boat, you know, we had several boats, little net sheds on the beach, and went off fishing, dug some worms. I thought, well, I must go out fishing, you know, because fishing we've always done here by rod lines or nets or whatever you. And I was out there fishing away merrily, catching bass, I'm sure I was, and suddenly the water just ahead of me erupted, you know, with obviously bullets hitting, and then I could hear the machine gun fire from Inchmary House, from along there. And I thought, you know, this is murder. It's broad daylight, I mean, and I waved my oils, you know, when I have it up. But anyway, they just fired again, but not at me, but near. But eventually I moved. I thought, you know, I'll move a little bit this way to the east, as though I'm not in front of them, you see. Perhaps they were firing, you know, they didn't have targets on the matter or anything, but they may have just, but anyway, they fired again, so in the end I came on in. I thought, well, that's enough of that. I mean, they weren't firing to hit me, otherwise, I mean, at that range, they could have filled me full of holes, but I just thought, well, that wasn't very pleasant. But, you know, that was one of the things, but no one could say anything about it, because on the night coming home, that particular weekend or whatever it was, on the way down, we had a local baker ran a service for service personnel, like a taxi service if you were caught at the station. By the time I got to Southampton Central, it was sort of 11 or 12 at night, there were no buses, so I rang through and this chap Edwards came and picked me up. Well, on the way, no, it was earlier than that, it may have been, I don't know, it was late evening anyway, but we got past the Langley Tavern there. It must have been a little after closing time, which would have been about 10:30 then. And there was a crowd of people ahead, and I could see them. But the next thing, a motorbike passed us, and where these troops were walking down the road, it ran into them, and the motorcycle fell over, and the chap fell out in the road. Well, I could see this. And the next minute, this Edward, I said, stop! He's going straight at this bloke. Well, the lights they had were louvered. That no light shone up level, they only shone down, and they were louvered shields so there was no glare up to aircraft, you see. And but you could only see sort of 30 yards. You couldn't see any more. Not unless I've always a good eye. Anyway, I said, Christ, stop. And but he stopped too late. We ran over this chap. And anyway, I jumped out being a medic, and these lads crowded all round and jabbering in French. So I grabbed him. I said, come on, we've got to get him. I know where they are. At Inchmere, I knew where they were stationed. And I said to the others, OK, medic, leave it with me. Got in, but he'd been hit here on the head, but he was dead. But he was there and then he was dead because there was no pulse. And, you know, I immediately felt for his pulse here and here, but nothing. And I thought, he's dead. But we took him to Inchmere. We drove in there. There was a guard at the gate. And we had this body, you see. And I tried to explain what happened. But the next morning I went there before this fishing episode, but they knew nothing about it. Denied all knowledge of it, so there's nothing good to do about that. I mean, they were the free French training to go over, obviously, but prior to the D-Day landings, because that's what they were trained for here, you know. And but that's just a couple of incidents on one visit home. But
how long was that before D-Day? Roughly?
Well, it was only it could have been. Let me think. I'll tell you now. It was maybe 2 or 3 months, 2 to 3 months before prior to D-Day.
I'm surprised that you were actually allowed to get into a boat and go out.
Well, we had a boat. It was a dinghy which was registered for fishing, you see, which my father had done before he died, because you had to have that here. But I can remember we fished one evening out here with my brother-in-law, you know, Johnny, Audrey's husband, and my twin brother, you know, who's now dead. But we went off just fishing. But of course the light came down, it got dark, and I said, we're all right. We're only just off here, you see. The next thing, a downgrade, suddenly we can hear these noises. I said, flash your torch. See, we had a torch, so we flashed it around quick. And, you know, see, the next thing, a searchlight pinned on us. And it was a naval craft saying, what the hell do you think you're doing here? I said, we're bloody well fishing. And they told us to come on in. We had to come on in. But it was obvious these things were necessary. But this little boat had, if I remember it, I'm just trying to think of the number. I had a boat, four. I can't, at this time, I don't think I can think of the number. But it was registered, just a dinghy, you know, a fishing dinghy, which had a bench at the back.
So when you were out there on the water,
yeah.
Could you see anything of the mulberry stuff up at...
Well, no, it was... you couldn't see anything. There were no lights visible anywhere. No shipping carried lights either.
No, but in the daytime, could you see anything?
Well, no, because when I was on leave, I only saw them towing this one out for this particular weekend. I knew what they were doing at Stansford, round there, but once they'd manufactured them and rolled them off, up the river here, they were in two docks, which had sheet piled doors, you know, entrances to them. The remnants are still up there at the other side on Bewley Estate. Ehrman's Dock, it's called. There's a L shape. There's one in that way and one that way. Husbands at Marchwood were in charge of the operation then. I know now. I couldn't say I knew then. But those at Stansford was another group. Well, people living here worked down there, so I knew what was going on. But there was something you didn't talk about in those days. I mean, all things were hush-hush, weren't they? I mean, we didn't... Our letters home and letters from our parents to us never mentioned these things, because those things... Well, they were disallowed anyway, any mention of that. But they built them, but they all towed over towards Ryde across there. And, well, if you go around this, what's called Old Castle Point on the Isle of Wight there, round to a bay there near King's Quay and all there, there's an anchorage all along there. They had those harbours and they were moored there.
Well, a collecting point.
Well, that was a collecting point to be towed away across the channel. At the same time, they had a fuel lines, you know, going from the refinery here down through Stansford to this beach at the bottom here, and they had 14 lines across the Isle of Wight. And then from the other side of the Isle of Wight, prior to this, they ran these lines across the channel so far. They were about that, I suppose, about 3-inch lines carrying the fuel across the other side. That's quite an effort, wasn't it? Well, D-Day wasn't just the Mulberry Harbours, it was getting fuel over there. And the way they did it, they used these shuttle pontoons, which had these huge drums of this pipe on, which was a, it was made, 80-odd% tin, the rest lead for me. Not on the shore bases, they're all iron. There's still relics of them down here and over on the other side and everywhere on the French side as well. But then they ran them across the channel, these lines, to so as to pump fuel across to the invading forces once they'd landed, you know. Once they were substantiated at bridgehead, then they had to have fuel, didn't they? So they had this already. People didn't realise that, but it was more or less already. By the time they got the Mulberry Harbours there, they only had to connect the shorelines in from where they'd taken them so far across at night, you know, at various times. That's been quite an operation, that.
Must have been. I mean, that all came from the Agri...
refinery. From the refinery there, yeah. That's right.
That's
what it was. And that's quite a long haul to run pipelines. It was quite simple to run them from here to the Isle of Wight.
So it implies that they've been planning this for...
Oh, it's obviously been planned a long time. It wasn't just a 5-minute wonder. I mean, to go across the Calais, it was so well defended, that area, there wasn't any point in doing that. I mean, that was obviously the... One would have thought that maybe 21 miles is not too far, but so bad. I mean, you can see Cap Grenade, you stand anywhere along Dover to Deal, anywhere along that front, as long as your visibility is good. I mean, today you can drive and see the French coast, but as far as the other way, this thing must be about 80 miles, isn't it? Something, somewhere 70 or 80.
You were talking, not last time, but the time before, when I first saw you, about there's some bearings or something still on the shore.
Oh yes, the
what were those for?
Well, where they built the Mulberry Harbours in Stansrud Bay, that they built a concrete and brickwork revetment and platform where they built them on high level ground. But then they had to get them into the sea, and they'd built a slope of concrete biscuits. Well, to get them over there, what they did, they where they built them on the base, you know, obviously with the shuttering ply and everything, they had all these like giant ball bearings there, and they just rolled them and pushed them along, whatever way, and then they went over the edge, and at high tide, you see, they had to drop down into the sea, which was only perhaps a couple of metres down the slope. But many of those ball bearings, obviously they were disposable. I mean, some of them went below the shoreline or underground, but there are still relics of them there now. And I told you, a lad who thought they were cannonballs, and he said, "Never I found some cannonballs from the old days." You know, he, in his mind, I mean, ships of the line then used to anchor down. The Stansrud Bay was an anchorage from the southwest, or prevailing winds or southwest in the sailing ship days. Obviously, they didn't. You wouldn't stay out here where you're exposed. You would go in that bay around there. Which, if you read some of the old books on history, remember those dark pine trees down there weren't there, and you could see from Hethi Down, and Leap was the, and Hethi Down was the vantage spot into the bay. And that bay was Stansrud Bay. Across there, you could look, the ships of the line would be anchored around those. But that's where these same things are. There's still chain and material down there where they hauled them off, because they used purchase gear as well as people pushing. They would pull them down, like with a winch, and through snap gear, they would use, you know, sheave blocks, so that they would run them and they could pull those big, I mean, these, I don't God knows how many tons they were, but they were a massive thing. And they just pull them over, and then they were rolling along on these ball bearings, or giant, like giant ball bearings. So it was a great procedure to get them into the sea. It was, the area was absolutely ideal for that purpose, unless they went up the river there, they had to dig out these docks, dig them out into the mud and drain them out and put a platform in and start building them in there. Well, down there they could have used the natural resources of the earth, level earth. And
How does the shoreline go then?
It's very steep, Stansrud Bay. Yeah, that's between Stone Point and Calshot. It's quite a steep run, yeah. And these caissons, or they were called caissons, I suppose, they're rectangular or square. They all had big valves in them, but they were quite hollow. They were like a ship almost, like a concrete ship, hollow, and of course they would float anywhere. But once they got on the other side, they opened the seacocks and let the water in. And then, they, you know, obviously their weight deposited them onto what was there, a good level surface, sandy surface, you know. So they became sometimes a bit irregular, but they sent divers down then and jetted out to level them out so that they could go from one to the other, make roadway across. Yeah. Quite an ingenious device when you think of... Because once they had to land there. It's obvious. There was no point in just sending a few troops. It had to be tanks, everything, lorries, and a mass of equipment. If you're going to invade an already occupied territory, you can't just do it with a few people. It's got to be done and be sustainable, hasn't it? And once they started to make progress, they still had to ship all the materials across, you know, the war materials, fuel, but, you know, I suppose, ammunition, guns and everything all had to go that way.
So these caissons, tell me if I've got it right, they both made a sort of a breakwater and also a roadway for tanks and lorries.
That's right. They were used as a roadway as much as anything, as well as a breakwater, yeah.
Right.
Mainly as a roadway, initially. Yeah, well, where they were floated in and sunk, then they lined them up and then they levelled them up, and of course it's easy to put stuff, metal materials across, like the bridging people from the REs did some of that, so that you had a roadway across for your lorries. Your landing craft would come in at high tide, you see, and deposit these vehicles on there.
Is it quite a shallow?
It's still there.
But the caissons are still there?
Yeah, many of them are still there, aren't they, I believe, on the other side.
I don't know. Is it quite shallow on the French side then?
Yeah, well, in that area, when I say quite shallow, it is, I would suggest, not running off deep like it does here, but it's quite level ground for an area. I imagine they chose it as such. It had to be an area which initially would not be thought to be going to be used. So they had to devise the means to use this type of ground, you know, for, or this method of getting their equipment in.
So you have to think of an unobvious way of doing it. The Germans wouldn't actually guess what you were going to do.
That's right. This is the whole thing was extremely well planned, obviously. I remember that many of the people were trained, because I was in Inverary then, at the old Duke's. I was in the castle where we had a hospital there. But we had all the American, Canadian, Polish, you name it, forces there training with tanks, and British forces, obviously, for this. I mean, we didn't know at that time, that's what it, but that was the training ground for these people.
So where was that?
In Inverary, in Argyllshire, on Loch Fyne. See, there's a huge sea lock coming in, yeah, above Glasgow, about 60 miles north of Glasgow. Yeah, it's on Loch Fyne. And it was obvious that was the training ground. I mean, they had other training grounds, obviously, down in Dorset, all sorts of areas. But understandably, I mean, the whole thing was a secret. No one knew what it... At the same time as that, you see, there had been the invasions of North Africa. There were all sorts of things going on prior to this. But the whole... All of these things were... like the Dieppe affair was only a shock affair, which it wasn't intended to win. The Dieppe affair wasn't an invasion, but it had to be put on the cards as an invasion. Oh, that was pretty obvious.